Welcome to Galaxy Brains. As always, I'm your host, Alex Thorne, head of research at Galaxy. Thank you for listening to Galaxy Brains. We have a great show for you today. We're going to talk with Tyler Williams, head of policy at Galaxy Digital, and of course, our friend Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading. No rap today. Again, I'm on the road, but we'll be back next week with some music. Before I get to the rest of the podcast, I need to remind you, please refer to the link to the disclaimer in the podcast notes and note that none of the information in this podcast constitutes investment advice or an offer, recommendation, or solicitation by Galaxy Digital or any of its affiliates to buy or sell any securities. Let's hop right into it with Bimnet Abibi. Let's go now to our friend Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading. As always, Bimnet, welcome to Galaxy Brains.
Thanks for having me.
Always great to have you on Galaxy Brains, and kind of an exciting week in macro. I'm sounding like a broken record. It continues to be exciting in the world of macroeconomics. I guess you tell me, but I've been traveling, so I haven't been as close to it. But the big news was a hot CPI print.
Yes, we got a very strong CPI number today. It printed 0.4 month on month, and you know there's lots of details in the report that suggest that inflation is likely creeping higher, and that you know the data that we saw in January and February weren't aberrations, but they are part of a broad theme of inflation being higher than what folks expected. The areas where we saw a reasonable amount of strength, you know, that I thought were notable were, you know, things like car insurance and healthcare costs. Like, you know, those things are moving up higher pretty quickly. And all of a sudden, you know, it used to be that people would make the argument that the 3-month run rate for inflation or the 6-month run rate for inflation is below target. Now it's well above. And, you know, when you look at things like, you know, services inflation ex housing, you know, those figures are you know, well above 4%, and now you know are in areas where the Fed should feel uncomfortable about cutting, and so you know, given the big beat and the details of the beat, the market has started to price out a lot of cuts for this year. 2 years treasuries were off by, you know, 22-23 basis points. So almost a full cut getting, you know, baked out of that 2-year point. And yeah, you know, the bright spots to it, I would say, are the components that showed the most strength aren't necessarily going to show up in PCE. Like, you know, I think the healthcare stuff, for example, doesn't get included in PCE. And so there's an argument to be made that, you know, depending on how PPI comes out, you know, this might not impact PCE as much, but you know it's really hard to ignore these CPI figures. I mean, they're well above the Fed's target. It does not indicate that inflation is slowing. It looks like it's reaccelerating. The job market is still hot, and you know, it fits the narrative of just, you know, a hot economy that we've had over the past couple of months. And so, I think there's a lot of, you know, cold water being thrown onto Powell's arguments for why he wanted to cut 3 times and why the Fed officials had 3 cuts in their, you know, dot projections.
Yeah, I saw Mike Novogratz had tweeted he didn't see any good reason to cut rates at this point. No reason at all. I got to hand it to you, Bimnet. You've been saying this at this point for months, basically, that there's no real reason to cut, that you don't feel the need to cut here, that the economy is doing well without the cuts. We don't need the cuts. And that inflation looked pretty sticky. Markets weren't very pleased with that number, though.
Yes. Right?
Probably, I mean, it makes sense if you're repricing now, fewer cuts. What do we have now? What's the expectation now for end of the year number of cuts?
It's
2?
A little, no, it's actually under 2 now.
Wow.
It's closer to, like, you know, 1.5, one, you know.
So basically it's like maybe 1 is kind of what
like maybe there's 1 to 2. Like, 1 to 2 is kind of the established, you know, range now. And you've seen a bunch of, you know, sell side banks reduce their forecast from 3 cuts to 2 already on the year. You know, there are certain things that, you know, like I'll give you an idea about, like, how hard it is to kind of, you know, really get a grasp on the data. So we had the small business survey that came out yesterday, and the employment component was super soft. And typically, you know, small business employment leads the broader unemployment rate, you know, for the economy, because, you know, small businesses can move faster than big institutions, et cetera, et cetera. So the labor market for small business is looking awful. However, then you start looking at their expectations with respect to raising prices. And the price increase component was really strong. And so we're seeing a situation where, you know, even if the, you know, hiring and stuff is slowing a little bit, or it might slow, like the price pressures are still there. And then on top of that, you have a commodity complex that's trading incredibly well. You know, part of it is a function of, you know, oil going bid on some of these Mideast headlines. Some of it's a function of the stimulus efforts in China. And so, you know, you're seeing things like copper trade well. But, you know, at the end of the day, if gas prices are higher, like that is bad for inflation.
Right.
Now, the flip side to all of this stuff is that inflation, at least for a large portion of the population, is actually a tax. Right. So if you're telling me that your car insurance premium is up 25% this year, right, and you're paying $100 a month, now it's $125, like that $25 is essentially a tax on you. And we know that, you know, incomes aren't keeping up with a 25% like increase. And right. So more and more, you know, given, you know, where savings are in the economy, like people aren't, the savings rate isn't like, you know, COVID levels, 20-30%. You know, anymore. People are not, you know, net spending, not net saving anymore. And so you've seen excess savings come down, and you're now seeing, you know, price for a lot of like everyday goods go up. And so, you know, that's going to eat into the consumer a lot. And I would say that, you know, folks have already, you know, adjusted a lot of their behaviors because of these price increases. Like, I'll give you an example. Like, if you're going out to eat with your family like 3 to 4 times a week, you know, when you know prices were reasonable, let's say you've already cut that down to 2 to 3, or once, you know, a week, mm-hmm. or once mm-hmm. a month. But now, you know, you're like, you're grocery shopping more, but now your grocery prices are starting to increase more. And it's like, well, then there's the people that went from shopping at high-end grocers to mid-tier grocers. And so that behavioral shift in the economy has already happened. And so when you start to see inflation tick higher again with this low savings base, it makes you think that the consumer is really going to slow down. And that's precisely what you are getting out of, you know, U.S. companies that are consumer oriented, and how those consumer, you know, discretionary companies are trading, and the guidance that they're giving is that the U.S. consumer is slowing down, and this inflation is likely not going to help. So I feel like, you know, Powell's stuck between a rock and a hard place, where, you know, that there's so many conflicting pieces of evidence. And there's not really like you should do this with like a high level of confidence. And so I'm sitting here being like, Powell has a hard job. Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, what are the best things to hedge Powell's jobs? It's still gold. It's still silver. It's still Bitcoin. It's, you know, real world assets that protect purchasing power.
And let's talk about Bitcoin real quick, just the near-term outlook. You know, we had run as low as what, like 62-ish a couple weeks ago. Then we made it up to the 72K range earlier this week. Actually, I think was that not yesterday, but the day before, so Monday. And then on this news, along with other stuff, right, Bitcoin down, you know, back in the 67, 68 range. Do we care? Is this just kind of noise at this point? Like Bitcoin's still in that range?
Well, Bitcoin's already rallied strong from that morning sell-off. I mean, we're back like 69, like 200 right now, which, you know, tells you that, like, it's a dangerous thing to short. And, you know, you've seen a little bit of a short covering rally, you know, today in the afternoon. And broadly speaking, like this is a healthy bullish consolidation, right? Like prices, you know, need to like calm down, and it gives people, you know, more confidence that the market is mature. And it flushes out the weak hands, you know, the mm-hmm, guys that mm-hmm. are just, you know, in there for a couple percent here and there, and they can't hold bags, like they get chopped out of the market. And then you're left with a situation where market starts going up and the people holding it are not really sellers until much higher levels. And so the way I'm looking at it, you know, from a chart perspective and just from a, you know, a general sentiment perspective is that this is just chop. This is consolidation. The fundamentals are still there. I think anybody in Bitcoin does, I don't really know many people that are like real, like believers in Bitcoin that are selling it. And, you know, the equity folks that are picking it up in retirement accounts, these are buy and hold types, people that have been conditioned to buy and hold every asset in their accounts for a really long time. And so, you know, I think the setup's still there. And then you've got the catalyst in terms of the halving coming up as well. Who knows how you know, crypto will trade around that. But I'll say, high level, I'm very comfortable holding Bitcoin right now. And the best thing to do with holding an asset like Bitcoin is just not trade it around too much, because you never know when you're going to get those 7, 8, 9, 10% days.
Yeah, we've done that work and shown that it's like, you know, 80% of the gains were on like 5 days in 1 year or 10 days,
yes.
right?
And so if you miss those days, it's almost impossible to match the performance of the Bitcoin. Yep. And so, you know, I would just generally say that, you know, stay long and strong, stick with the trend, and protect your purchasing power. PPP.
There you go.
Push and pee.
BIMnet, Abibi, I love it. My friend BIMnet from Galaxy Trading, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Let's go now to our guest, Tyler Williams, Galaxy's head of public policy. Tyler, thank you for coming back to Galaxy Brains, my friend.
Of course, it's been a long time. Good to be back with you.
Has it been? I can't remember. We've been on many times. I guess it hasn't been this year yet. So sometime in 23.
Yeah, I think we did a wrap-up call at the end of last year, maybe just sort of quick hits. But I don't think we've really gotten into any substance in a while.
Well, you're back. We're back. Markets have evolved and matured, dare I say, grown certainly a lot since whenever that was. So we want to check in with you on a couple topics. You know, I'm going to go into a few, but before we do that, I'm in DC with you. We were at the Bitcoin Policy Institute's policy summit yesterday at the National Press Club. I thought it was a great event. What did you think of it? This is a real policy wonky event, but it was
I think they did a fantastic job. They had a great lineup of lawmakers and policymakers throughout the executive branch at the conference. I think at one point they had 16 or 17,000 people live streaming the event. And it was a packed house in all of in the main room and the ballroom for, you know, the fancy high level speakers, the Chairman McHenry, et cetera. But it was even
Senator
a packed house
was in, there. Yeah,
exactly. There's a ton of folks there. I think Representative Nickel was there as well. But it was a packed house in the main ballroom, and it was also a packed house in like the side conversations that were going on during the conference as well. So great event.
Yeah.
And I think this is only their second year doing it. So to see what they've built in this sort of short order and the influence that they've been able to exert in Washington is quite refreshing.
Yeah. Yeah. Shout out to David and Grant from the Bitcoin Policy Institute. Really great. Really great event. Saw a lot of good friends there. Gave a fiery political speech, which I know that was your favorite moment. You were just telling me off camera that my speech was your favorite part of the conference.
Some have been saying, I won't name names, but some have been saying that it was the best speech of the event.
They'll post that on YouTube for our audience at some point, so I'll share that link. But we're going to talk, Tyler, about crypto regulation and legislation and all that stuff in a minute. But before we do, let's just talk about the sort of broader Washington legislative macro stuff. What does the calendar look like? What is on the forefront of the House's mind at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So I think most people remember, most listeners will remember the consternation that was going on around the funding of the government. And there was always sort of teetering on this edge of are we or will we not fund the government? So I think we've largely moved past that, and we've moved into this world of, I want to call it like the springtime, early summer, the pre-August recess that Washington's known for, where we've moved into these silos and verticals of discrete policy issues. So now the conversation has moved into reauthorizing FISA and FISA reform and FAA reauthorization. And we moved into this conversation about additional funding resources for Ukraine. And I think that when I think about these issues, we see engagement from the speaker and the leader in the Senate in terms of like where there may be maybe overlap in terms of coming together on issues. And I think that there are vectors that are created of sort of policy opportunities, so to speak, where legislators in the crypto space, the people who really care about a digital asset policy, they're looking at those issues as opportunities to attach their projects to. So that's how I think about how things are shaping up in the next 2 or 3 months.
And then we've discussed what those policy issues are on the table sort of in Congress for digital assets. It's been stablecoins, market structure, some illicit activity questions, some other stuff. But like what does the landscape look like? What has any traction right now? What are the big crypto and digital asset topics? And then what are the likelihoods that they come to fruition this Congress?
Yeah, well, I'll get to that question. Let me answer a question you didn't ask prior to that. So I think in the financial services world, the world of things that are being talked about is the Safer Banking Act, the ability for depository institutions to provide banking services to legal cannabis businesses. And that's relevant to this debate in a couple of different ways. There's also the Recoup Act, which is the executive compensation clawback for bank executives. So those are sort of like two big areas that we've seen some agreement or desire to work on from both the House and the Senate and R's and D's. And those are magnets for germane, but sometimes controversial legislation. And what I'm talking about is the interchange legislation, like the Durbin-Marshall legislation for price caps for the card networks. And also there can be opportunities for other pieces of legislation, such as the stablecoin legislative matters or the market infrastructure, the digital asset market structure legislation. In my opinion, I think it's really hard to attach bills because once one member or one senator starts asking for their pet project, then other ones are raising their hands. So you just get into this debate where there has to be there has to be a picking of which is going to get in, which isn't. Mm-hmm. And the more things that are added, the tougher it is to have your project in there. So I guess I think that of the things that could be opportunities for in the digital asset space, stablecoins has the best opportunity right now in the next 6-7 months.
It felt like they got really close to doing it, what, 2 summers ago with Maxine Waters when she was still the chair of the House Financial Services Committee, that it seemed like there really wasn't that much daylight, at least on paper, policy-wise, between the various, the Republican and the Democratic sides. The question was mostly around who should regulate a regulated stablecoin issuer, right? And it was like, should it be a bunch of whomever, banking regulators or state regulators, which is sort of the Republican side? And it seemed like the Democrats were saying at the time in that debate, like it should be the Fed. And that I don't really recall there being any other disagreements. Now, is that right? First of all, is my memory correct? And then also, even though that seems small, like that's actually a pretty big disagreement that has big implications. Maybe that's why. But are we close? I mean, to get it done, it would have to answer that question, right? Who regulates it? And is that something that can be negotiated?
Of course, it's something that can be negotiated. I think you're spot on and you're correct in the assessment of the issues. It's largely this state versus federal pathway and the duality approach, which I'll just remind people that we have like a dual banking system, like we do have that. And it's also the ability or sort of the requirement of federal approval at the end of the day for state licensed entities and state pathways. So I think it is largely that. And in my opinion, I don't think that the negotiators are terribly far apart. But again, it's still a question. Like it is a big first step, and you have to get sort of consistent alignment across a lot of different constituents, being the NEC, the Fed, Treasury. You have to get the stakeholders in Congress to agree. So it's just a lot of people that need to be in the room all singing from the same sheet of music. And sometimes that is difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about illicit finance, which, you know, has been a big issue, particularly re-raised by Senator Elizabeth Warren following the Hamas's attacks on Israel on October 7th, with her Digital Asset Anti-Money Laundering Act proposal in the Senate. We've spoken at length in general, both of us. I've had people on this show about why we think DAML, that bill, is bad law, and effectively a ban on crypto in America. But first of all, where does that stand? She was adding co-sponsors, you know, like a dripping faucet for a while, but I haven't seen anything over the last couple months. What is the likelihood there? And has there been any I haven't seen any alternative proposals if this is such a big deal, which I'm saying that's if, but if it is, wouldn't I expect to see more proposals out there than just Senator Warren's? What's the status on hers and any competitive other drafts that are out there?
Yeah, absolutely. So just to back up, so the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Treasury was before the Senate Banking Committee yesterday while the Bitcoin Policy Institute conference was going on. So there's a lot of attention.
Wally Adeyemo.
Right? Yes, exactly. So he was up there testifying about illicit finance, and there was obviously a lot of focus on digital assets. Largely driven by a healthy amount of senators who sit on the banking committee and their respective interest in this policy issue, because as we all know, when we saw the fall of last year moving into the winter, there was just a heightened focus on these issues post the terrorist attacks in Israel.
Yeah.
So I think we've seen that, and we've seen that continue. I think Senator Warren, on her piece of legislation, is up to 20 or so co-sponsors, which is a material portion of the U.S. Senate. And I think what we've also seen is that there's become more interest from some of the members on the banking committee who haven't always been interested in digital asset or crypto policy. So if you watched the hearing yesterday, you'll recall that Senator Tillis and Hagerty had put out a discussion draft of legislation. And I think how they're viewing it is it's their policy response to the asks that the Deputy Secretary and the Treasury Department had for additional resources and authorities relative to their authorities for FinCEN and for sanctions. So we've seen efforts on the Democratic side from Senator Warren and Senator Warner, and now we've seen Republican interest from Senators Tillis and Hagerty. And in my view, even though there's a lot of consternation and this engenders a lot of sort of tension in the digital asset policy or ecosystem writ large, there are more people who are in the debate on these issues, which is a net positive if you want progressive activity to happen. And what I mean by that is you have to get to 60 votes to vote on something in the U.S. Senate for it to become law and get advanced to the president's desk. And the more people are interested means the more people that can potentially get behind other things like stablecoin legislation or market structure. Because at the end of the day, for any of these things to happen, there has to be a deal cut that gets to 60 votes. Yep. So that's what matters as I see it.
Interesting. Some interesting clips from that hearing. People should check out on YouTube too. I enjoyed it. I did see the exchange that Senator Tillis had. I thought it was quite interesting. Haven't heard him speak publicly very often about digital assets, but I will say he and Senator John Hickenlooper did introduce the PROOF Act in 2023, which is the Proving Reserves of Others on Others Funds Act. It mandates proof of reserves in the digital asset economy for, you know, third-party custodians, which I thought was a great bill. And we had members of both his staff and Hickenlooper's staff on this show. So go check that out. So great to see him staying involved and interested in this issue.
Yeah, and I think it's strange. Like, a lot happened in 2022. Not much has happened in digital asset policymaking in the successive years since the calamitous blowups of 22. But substantive issues and substantive policy proposals that would largely address these issues haven't been advanced. So it's a question of, like, what can we do to move the conversation forward to have good things happen to protect customers in the U.S. and promote the economy in the U.S.?
Yeah, and not to, you know, just continuously beat this dead horse, but Senator Warren said after Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced to jail on Twitter, she wrote that this all, you know, reminds us that We need legislation to, you know, protect people's money from people like Sam Bankman-Fried. And I would just point out that her bill does nothing to protect or prevent protect customers or prevent the next FTX at all. But something like the PROOF Act absolutely would specifically address that blow up. So good to see it, a growing number of thoughtful legislators getting involved with interesting new proposals. So and what do you think? Just to clearly, like, I mean, Undersecretary Adamo?
Deputy Secretary.
So he like basically runs FinCEN, right? Like he's the.
I would think of him as the layer between the undersecretaries at Treasury, which there's three separate verticals at Treasury. There's domestic finance, international affairs, and then TFI, the terrorism and financial intelligence, which oversees FinCEN. And then he sits as the layer between those three verticals and the secretary.
Oh, wow. No, he's like number two at Treasury then.
Number two at Treasury.
Wow. That's a big job. Does him talking about this more and appearing at the hearing yesterday, does it increase the odds or is it putting more pressure on getting something done? Like, again, you were talking about how we're in this spring to – you're already talking about the August recess. It's literally April 10th as we record this. How much time is there to get something done and in general in Congress? But also, like, does this likelihood of illicit finance, is it likely to get done one way or another or at all? Like, what's the – like, is it increasing? Like, what's the temperature on it?
I think it's just – so to answer that question specifically, I think – illicit finance and AML reforms, whatever, I don't know what the end product looks like that will be enacted. I feel relatively confident that something will happen in that area. And it's almost become table stakes for other things happening in crypto policy. So as I think about like stable coins and AML, they pair pretty succinctly together because at the end of the day, we're talking about sort of bank-like enterprises and bank-like products. And they pair nicely together because we put a lot of onus and responsibility on our depository institutions for performing BSA, AML, KYC, KYE requirements over the years. So it's almost become table stakes. Now, I think if we get that right, it unlocks the future of other progress in legislative areas.
Interesting. You know, we didn't talk about this, but it is election year. Literally, we're in it now. We've got a vice presidential nominee from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. We've got Vice President Kamala Harris, but we have no nominee yet from former President Trump, who is almost guaranteed to be the Republican nominee at this point, effectively is. Not asking you to predict who it might be, but that's not the point of the question. But how's the vibe changing, whether it's on the Hill or just in Washington? At some point, I mean, we've all lived this many times. Well, the older you are, the more times you've lived it. But eventually, the entire discussion becomes consumed with the election. I think we're not quite there, is my sense yet, where it's not the only thing. But, you know, that further reduces the window for progressive new legislation, does it not?
I certainly think it does. I think you were talking a little bit about the floor schedule and the time that is left in Congress. And yes, you're right. We're talking about August recess already. But if you think about just sort of the math of when the House and the Senate are both in session for the rest of the year, and just a reminder to people that the fiscal year in D.C. ends September 30th. So really working backwards from that time frame, it's like 6 weeks that we really have, in my opinion, of like real legislating item. And if you think about the U.S. Senate, it takes a good amount of time to people in D.C. say get onto a bill. And when they talk about get onto a bill, it's the amount of floor time that they have to burn to move the debate forward in the U.S. Senate. And it takes a lot of hours to do that in our legislative process. So we don't have much time. So that's why I was talking about those vectors of opportunities and sort of like the legislating things like that. You really have to focus on those discrete issues as it relates to the potential opportunity to add things into. And it's a really small number of days and small amount of time and items.
Tyler, what else is on your mind when it comes to regulation in Washington, whether it's regulation or legislation or policy or what's interesting here that people should be looking into, or what are you looking at beyond what we've discussed? Anything standing out?
Maybe I'll just harken back to the theme of some of the BPI conference, because I think one thing that was resounding to me is obviously the Bitcoin Policy Institute is there to promote and defend and talk about Bitcoin. They are singularly focused. And that's really good in Washington because policymakers and lawmakers in particular have constituents that are diverse and all across like the US and all across the globe and different issues, and they hear and listen to them. That's their job. And for the digital asset economy to be successful in legislating, you have to be really, really singular focused. So that was a resounding thing that I think we heard from BPI.
Yeah, like you can't just going with the giant like Web3 and Bitcoin and all these and digital assets. It's like too big, right? You need to like make it clear and simple, right? In a way, to have real success. Yeah, and
maybe I'll leave it with this. Like the thing that I heard Chairman McHenry talking about the other day was he seems pretty positive and bullish on his ability to get something done and creating durable law. And obviously, like I think he is acutely aware of the limited opportunities to make that happen. However, this is he's retiring, as most listeners will probably know as well. And I think he's going to spend a lot of time and effort and political capital in getting that done. He's been around for 20 years. So I'm hopeful and I look forward to the prospects of something good happening.
Yeah, it'd be great. I love the BPI. I like that their acronym is the same as the Bank Policy Institute, which is chaired by none other than our friend Jamie Dimon. But this is the Bitcoin Policy Institute. They did have a great summit again. Shout out to David and Grant there. Tyler, my friend, head of policy at Galaxy, Tyler Williams, thank you so much for coming back to Galaxy Brains.
Thanks again, Alex.
That's it for this week's episode of Galaxy Brains. Thanks to our guest, Tyler Williams, head of policy at Galaxy Digital, and our friend Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading, as always. We'll see you next week. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening to Galaxy Brains, the weekly podcast from Galaxy Research. If you enjoy the show, please like, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. To follow Galaxy Research, sign up for our weekly newsletter at gdr.email, read our content at galaxy.com/research, and follow us on Twitter at GLXY Research. See you next week.